This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Unfuck Your Intimacy, Relationships, Sex, and Dating by Faith G. Harper, PhD, LPCS, ACS, ACN. This book is read by Aaron Bennett. Introduction. Okay, intimacy. What the fuck do I mean by that? In a nutshell, intimacy is our human expression of how we express our most important interpersonal connections. And there are so many cultural messages about what are the right ways to experience intimacy and what is wrong, evil, sinful, or toxic. And about 99.44% of those messages are complete bullshit, like, so down to the brain science of the human experience, utter bullshit, that I knew this was an emotional health topic I really needed to write about. There are already tons of books out there about sex and relationships. My office and house are stacked to the brim with them. But most fall into one of two categories. They are either super straight-laced, presuming everyone is heterosexual, married, Christian, middle class, etc., or they dive deeply into very specific, outside-the-norm topics like kink or polyamory. And hey, a book specifically on sexual needle play does have its own target audience. But where are the books for the rest of us? People who don't fit the stereotype on either end, who are sex-positive, or are really trying to unpack all their upbringing so they can be, open-minded, or want to be, non-traditional, no matter how they have tried otherwise, and seeking good information on the variety of topics that are coming up in our lives. How does trauma affect our relationships? What about our religious and spiritual upbringings? How do we unpack our own shit? How do we connect better with our partners? No matter your circumstances, you deserve a happy, healthy, active life if you want one. So, I was looking to fulfill that goal with this book. Many of these sections are based on columns written for different publications or my own blog, usually responding to questions people had asked me. And if one person asks, they are probably not nearly the only one wondering. Who are you, anyway? I have a t-shirt that I often wear that says, "Not that kind of doctor." Being an epic nerd, I love the Doctor Who reference, but it also describes me well. The baristas at my local coffee place always remind me that I may not be that kind, but I am still their favorite, even if I can't prescribe any narcotics. My cup usually has Dr. Perv scribbled on it. My background is as a trauma therapist. In my work, I've realized that one place trauma shows up in everyday functioning is in people's intimate relationships. They are the relationships that require the most vulnerability, and when we have the most to gain, therefore the most to lose. There are so many ways that sexual intimacy can get fucked up in and because of our current culture. I couldn't be a trauma therapist and not be a sex therapist. I found I was working with people on issues surrounding their sexual relationships, so I started studying a lot. Enough, finally, to earn a postdoc in sexology. Yes, this literally makes me a sexologist. My life does not suck with that as a job title. As a therapist, sexologist, I think I have two main jobs. The first is to coach, to figure out how to help you improve your performance. And by that, I mean help you reconnect on an intimate level with yourself and your partners, present or future. To figure out what is negotiable and what is not. To figure out what you want your relationships to look like, and then start building in that direction. The second job is intimately, see what I did there, tied to the first, permission giver. I so often give people permission to start or stop doing something that can immediately impact their intimate relationships. If something is a problem, I give you permission to take it off the table. We can renegotiate it later. If there is something you want to explore, I give you permission to try it. You are allowed to use a vibrator. You are allowed to stop intercourse if it hurts. You are allowed to schedule an actual date with your partner and enjoy each other's company. You are allowed to not go home for the holidays if sharing a bedroom with your partner is a point of contention with your family. You can do the thing or not do the thing. My job is to help you figure out what the thing is and encourage you to get back out there and be in charge of your life. I'll be right here, rooting for you in my nerdy t-shirt. What is this book about? This book is about building intimacy, with or without a partner, through personal and sexual expression. You know, the shit like consent, boundaries, and communication that we don't talk about on the regular, although we really fucking should. This book will ask a lot of questions. It is surprising what we figure out about ourselves when the right questions are asked. Apply to all types of relationships, not just heteronormative pairs. All kinds of relationship configurations exist. Here is to honoring all of them. Help you on whatever spiritual or religious path you walk or don't without judgment. If it is yours, it's right for you. So let's figure out how to put all of those pieces together the best we can. Acknowledge the impacts our upbringing, education, and sexual history have on our current intimate relationships. Address the impact of all traumas in relationships. I am a trauma therapist first and foremost, and everything I have created over the years was intended to work with trauma recovery rather than accidentally trigger more trauma reactions. We will address sexual trauma and medical problems. Many of my referrals come from medical doctors, and I know this is a big deal. Include some shorter-term strategies and tips for all the communication shenanigans and other everyday relationship shit that seems to, again and again, impact our sexual intimacy. Discuss the power of props, toys, lubricants, whatever works is on the table. A little practical advice can work wonders. Help you realize that intimacy is serious business, but not take it too seriously. Intimacy is one of the most fundamental expressions of who we are because we define ourselves in relation to others. But life in general is better handled with as much humor as grace, and hopefully this book reflects that. Some of the stuff we do is empirically funny, and that is a damn good thing. I want to provide you a prescription to improve how you navigate intimacy in relationships, and I want you to giggle some while we do that. Consequently, this book will not be a heavy strategic relationship guide. Those already exist, and there are plenty that I work from that are really good. I work from a mashup of relationship-specific therapies in my practice on any given day and invoke strategies from Gary Chapman's Five Love Languages, Sue Johnson's Attachment Theory, and John and Julie Gottman's Sound Relationship House Theory. I tend to queer them the fuck up, color you completely unsurprised, but the essential work is the same as originally developed. So just jacking their work and regurgitating their stuff back out and calling it my own would be a dick move. There is no 16-week plan with exercises and readings and assignments and all that jazz. There are no Jedi here in that regard. This also will not be a guide for either remaining in or leaving an abusive relationship. That is a whole other complicated endeavor that is way out of the scope of this book. If you are turning to this book because you are trying to figure out if your particular relationship may be abusive, listen to your gut and seek some active help. There is no shame in therapy and other mental health support when you are going through some shit. Someone with some training and perspective that can help you navigate your unique situation. It's really hard to see the forest when your face is pressed up right against the tree bark, right? So just how is knowing all this going to make your life better? Here's the plan. You are going to read this book and do amazing things if this approach resonates with you. It's all up to you. One of my favorite jokes is an old standard. How many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? None. We encourage the light bulbs to change themselves. I know, groaner. But seriously, true. Have you ever tried to make a toddler who hates Brussels sprouts eat them? Not without sheer force, and the pushback ain't pretty. I can't make you do anything you don't want to do. Also, I'm not allowed by the regulations of my license to force you to do Kegels. Aren't you relieved? But I do know a lot about sexuality and intimacy work and have found many common themes over the years. I'm going to share the benefit of the work I do in therapy in a workbook format that you can navigate on your own or with your own therapist. This book is divided into three parts. Maybe trite, but it was the best way I could figure out to organize all the things I wanted to say about intimacy and relationships. Part 1. How our intimacy gets fucked. Human beings are epically skilled at fucking up a good thing. How many bizarre messages have you received about sex and love over the years that really crimped your game? We got shame issues, abuse issues, religious messages. That's a lot of shit to navigate. Part 2. Unfucking our relationship with ourselves. We certainly can't have the kinds of deep interpersonal connection that we want if we first don't know what we actually really want. And not knowing that doesn't make us shitty human beings. It makes us products of a society that tells us how to be, what to be, and who to be. And if we push back on swallowing that flavor aid, it gets forced down our throats anyway, which means many of us have work to do in that domain. What's our authentic identity? How to communicate that with others? How do we interact with our own selves to be an authentic, connected human being? Have you never had a handle on it? Or did you, and then everything changed because you changed? You know, all that shit that should be encouraged and reinforced from the get-go. Part 3. Unfucking our relationships with others. Once we get a better handle on who we are, then we have to figure out who we are in connection and how to express that honesty and vulnerability and all that really horribly difficult shit. Remember, intimacy is interpersonal. Very few people are an island unto themselves. So how do we do this well in a world that is designed for us to fuck it up? That's it. We're going to just try some new stuff if you are willing. This is a book of let's try to figure out what's going on and here's some stuff that may help deal with it. One of my favorite expressions is crazy is just doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Let's try some different shit, okay? Part 1. How our intimacy gets fucked. Intimacy is supposed to be easy, right? I mean, neuroscience demonstrates that we are hardwired to connect to others. This is just how we are supposed to be in the world. So if it's all so natural, then why do we make such a fucking mess of it all the time? First of all, we're human and make mistakes because that's just part of the process. Also, it's an ever-changing process. We may have a handle on something and then boom, life thought it would be amusing to smash everything to smithereens. And if that shit weren't enough, there are so many toxic messages and mainstream bullshit shooting into our ear canals and eyeballs on the regular that we can't help but find our authenticity subverted on the regular. I want to start with the basics. There is so much cultural mythology about what sex is and isn't that I'm going to be addressing over and over and over again within this book. But I found these 5 overarching myths that I bump into over and over again. I swear, if I could just banish these myths, everything else would fall into place. But then I wouldn't have a job. I'm not sure what else I would be capable of doing to save the world. I'll have to marinate on that one. Myth 1. Only certain types of sex are real sex. There is a ridiculous idea that certain types of sex are real, or at least more valid and preferable to others. When we think of real sex, we usually think partnered, penetrative intercourse. But do you know how many people have active and fulfilling sex lives that do not engage in partnered, penetrative intercourse? Or for that matter, how many people have a lot of partnered penetrative intercourse who still have epically miserable sex lives? What actually is sex? A consensual act between one or more people, involving the stimulation of the vagina, vulva, clitoris, penis, testicles, or anus. for the purpose of pleasure and/or emotional or social connectedness. Oral sex? Still sex. Solo sex? Still sex. There are not categories of sex that are superior to others, unless the categories are good sex and bad sex, and you get to define those. Myth 2. Sex is intuitive and natural. We have this idea that sex should be all spontaneous, and that we just sort of get what our partner wants, that we are going to run across a field of flowers in slow motion to each other, that everything should be spontaneous and free-flowing, and it will be amazing all the time forever with the right person. Oh, please, what complete bullshit. I can vouch with all my years of clinical experience, never mind all my years of, experience, that kind of sex generally happens with the people that are the worst possible matches and in relationships that are completely unsustainable. Insecure attachments with ill-suited people causes a big chemical of rush that's fun for a minute. But as most of us have learned the hard way, relationships like these mean you are hanging on for the ride as long as you can, but this ain't someone you bring home to mama. Sustaining an enjoyable and long-lasting sex life with long-term partners takes fucking work, y'all, and communication, and effort, and yes, calendar management. You don't spontaneously run into the dentist to get your teeth cleaned, right? You make a plan. Making space for sexual intimacy is often also going to require some planning for execution. Not having a slow-motion Field of Daisies experience doesn't mean your relationship is a sexual failure. When I did my TEDx San Antonio talk, Sex, Shame, and Silence, back in 2013, and go Google that shit if you haven't seen it, I'm still proud as fuck of it, someone complained on Twitter that my definition of sex, the same one I previously used, didn't include the word natural in my definition. Now, sexual interest may be natural, unless you're ace or demi or gray, which makes it definitionally unnatural. But how we have sex? Not that natural. We are inventing ways to make it weird, interesting, complicated, and technologically advanced all the time. Even professional pervs like Kinsey, who was known for tying up his nutsack with a cord and jamming a toothbrush up his dick, would be all, "Damn, y'all," if he saw what we were up to now. Sexual desire may be natural, but expecting sex itself to fit some category of natural means we are setting up ourselves for a lot of stigma and shame. Ain't nobody got time for that. Myth 3. Sex education isn't a universal necessity. We are the most sex-obsessed country that never talks about sex in pragmatic ways. It's everywhere. Every car ad is pervy as fuck. Your steak dinner? Sex was used to sell it in some way, shape, or form. But sex education itself? Not acceptable. Just writing a sex column in the newspaper for the past 3 years has gotten me in hella trouble with the academic establishment. But if there is so much out there that isn't so natural and isn't so intuitive, then we need to have those conversations. And you know who we need to have these conversations with? Every fucking one. People with intellectual disabilities. People with physical disabilities. People with severe chronic mental illness. Kids. Parents. Older people with changing bodies. LGB people. Trans folks. Poly peeps. Kinksters. We all need access to the information about safe, healthy, and fun sex that meets our needs and our desires. Myth 4. Sex is not that important in the grand scheme of things. Okay, actually it isn't if everything is going well. If the sex is good, it's 10% of your relationship. If it's bad, it's like 90%. Is sex the most important thing in the world? Of course not. But people in Flint, Michigan are still in need of clean water, and I bet they also still care about their sex lives and don't like it when things aren't going well. Sex is important to most people. It's an important part of how we connect and communicate, and it often operates as the sparkly glitter glue that helps keep relationships together. If it's important to you, It's empirically important. Don't let anyone diminish that for you. Myth 5. Certain people are fundamentally undesirable, and you are probably one of them. Thank you, media, for continuing to perpetuate the myth that there is only one kind of attractiveness, and everyone else is just destined for misery and solitude. Unless you're an epically unbearable asshole, there's someone out there for you. Your quirks and flaws, whether real or perceived, do not make you unworthy of great sex and wonderful love affairs. I don't care how long you have been under the impression that you are an ugly duckling. I promise you that there are a decent number of people out there with a duck fetish. And there is nothing sexier than someone who loves their life and is out there enjoying it. That's how all us regular flawed people find their partners. Or on OkCupid. Semantics. My mission in life is to battle these myths in all the ways, shapes, and forms they show up in my clients' lives and in society. Kinsey was with me. We may have differing opinions about where a toothbrush goes, for fuck's sake, dude, in one's mouth, but whatever. Opinions differ. Sex lives differ. And that's what makes it all fascinating and so fun. Everything else contained in this book is a means to that end. How trauma fucks us up. Trauma is an emotional response to a terrible event like an accident, rape, or natural disaster. Immediately after the event, shock and denial are typical. Longer-term reactions include unpredictable emotions, flashbacks, strained relationships, and even physical symptoms like headaches or nausea. American Psychological Association. So, why are we talking about trauma? Besides the fact that, hi, I'm the trauma therapist who talks about trauma in relation to everything? Actually, it's just that. Trauma does impact everything, and was the reason I became increasingly interested in sexology as a field of study. The impact of trauma on people's intimate relationships was coming up over and over again in practice, and was often the impetus for people seeking help and support. And even for people who don't have PTSD or some other kind of lasting trauma response, we all deal with situations that are traumatic, things that shake things up, fundamentally change our lives in some way. And those changes have a huge impact on how we connect to others. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, is the tool clinicians use to assign mental health diagnoses like PTSD. What they allow as traumas for diagnosis is somewhat limited. I imagine any time you are trying to create a classification system, you have to draw the line of what counts and what doesn't. But it's unfortunate, because so many life events that are not covered can be classified as a trauma and can cause a trauma response. And not just the traditional stuff we think of, like being a soldier on deployment, or being abused, or getting in a terrible car accident. A lot of the things we talk about in this book may be something you end up realizing impacted you as a trauma. Maybe fucked up messages you got about your body, about your sexuality or gender not being respected by others. That the things you enjoy sexually are wrong, bad, or inappropriate. Of course, not every trauma we experience causes a trauma response. A trauma response happens when our traumatic experience goes unresolved. Trauma becomes an issue when you notice an ongoing impact on your daily functioning, which is just the clinical way of saying that your trauma history is impacting your ability to lead the life you want to lead. In short, we don't get what we need to heal. I wrote about this already, Unfuck Your Brain, Microcosm Publishing, 2017, so I won't wax on too much about it, but a nutshell overview bears repeating. How does a trauma response, or PTSD, develop? We experience traumas throughout our lives. No matter how we try to protect ourselves, no matter how we try to remain safe, terrible things can happen. And sometimes these terrible things happened when we were our youngest and most vulnerable selves, when we needed the protection of others who were unwilling or unable, for any number of reasons, to provide that safety net. When trauma happens, it impacts us. Of course it does. And research shows that we are able to process and move on from many traumas on our own. We process and make sense of the events that have occurred, and within a few months, we achieve our normal baseline functioning again. This may be a new normal that takes into account the impact of the trauma, but we are able to navigate the world and our relationships in generally healthy ways. But sometimes we get stuck. And research also shows that this usually happens within the first month of the trauma occurrence. For many, many reasons, either conscious or unconscious, we are not able to do the processing work necessary to make sense of the trauma and how it impacted our lives. It can often be very pragmatic reasons. The brain says, "We have other stuff to do right now. We don't have time to process a trauma." Processing a trauma can be a luxury of time and emotional energy that we don't always have. It could be that the traumas are coming in so fast and furious that our brains just go into survival mode and shut down processing to keep us safe. Sometimes our brains simply say, "No, I'm sorry, I don't know how to make sense of this for you," and the processing shuts down. And these are the times that we develop a trauma response, or even PTSD. It may not be the biggest or the worst trauma we experienced, but it is the one that, for whatever reason, we couldn't do the work on. And we begin avoiding the things that trigger the thoughts and feelings that we haven't found a way to make peace with. And sometimes we have no idea that's what's going on. Trauma and intimacy. The thing I like best about the APA definition of trauma that opens this chapter is that it honors the fact that all types of traumas have the potential to affect our intimate relationships. When I deal with the impact of trauma on intimacy, most of the individuals I work with are sexual abuse survivors, but not everyone. All kinds of trauma can create a barrier to the intimacy we want and crave, like struggling to be in the present moment without being triggered, unable to trust someone enough to be vulnerable, not knowing how to connect with a partner, etc. Trauma is also associated with many other co-occurring issues, including depression, anxiety, and addiction. All of these issues can present obstacles to intimacy. As with the rest of this book, the questions following are not intended to take the place of trauma-informed therapy. They are based on my training in trauma-informed care and are intended to operate as a good starting point in addressing trauma if you find that there is work you need to do in this domain with a therapist. Lisa Najavitz, the creator of the Seeking Safety model mentioned later in this chapter, is a big proponent of using self-compassion as a means of encouraging survivors to take back their power after a trauma. There are many ways to feel in charge of our lives again after our sense of safety has been violated. I have worked with individuals who become politically involved after a tragedy in an effort to change social structures that allowed for the traumatic events to occur. Individuals who began volunteering to work with others who have suffered a similar tragedy, and individuals who began engaging in new activities such as boxing classes and self-care, such as body work, in order to feel in control again. There are some self-compassion exercises at the beginning of part two of this book for you to check out. But even before that, you might find that unpacking your particular situation is also a great starting point. Some questions to ask yourself. What are some of the ways you can feel empowered? What are some other activities you were interested in exploring to feel more empowered after surviving a traumatic event? What would be the first steps you need to take to explore these options? Is that something you are interested in doing right now? Why or why not? When it comes to healthy, safe coping skills, we often already know what works for us, but it is difficult to remember to use those skills in a moment in which we are feeling distress. What are some of the safe coping skills that work best for you? What can you do to help you remember to use these skills? Are there individuals you can involve who can support you? Are there items you can have available or items you need to get rid of in order to remain safe? While it is one of the hardest ways to learn a life lesson, many people have reported that dealing with a trauma did help them develop life skills that they didn't have before, even if it was a lesson they never wanted to have to learn. What positive qualities did you develop in response to having to manage a traumatic life event? How could these skills help you in the future? What if you think your partner has a trauma response they aren't aware of? That's a tough one. A lot of times, my clients are super aware that they have a trauma history that is impacting their current relationships. They know there is work to be done, and they are actively doing that work. Sometimes, however, we have no clue about what's going on. My first car was a tiny, crappy thing with great gas mileage and crappy wiring. The taillight would go out on a regular basis whenever a passenger accidentally kicked the wiring box. I was bopping along, thinking I had no problems, when I was causing issues in traffic all around me. Fortunately, I lived in a small college town and knew most everyone. Someone would beep at me and yell, "Hey, Faith, light is out again! Almost rear-ended you!" I could pull over, wiggle the switch, and get it working again. Why did I never know the brake light wire had been kicked out again? Well, I was in the car, driving the thing around. It seemed okay from my perspective. It was the people trying to navigate around in our shared space that saw the problem. Fortunately, I never caused a horrible accident, or even a non-horrible one. Also fortunately, other people were available to help me to recognize the truth of the problem and alert me to it. This is a simple analogy for trauma, and trauma is rarely simple. Most people with a burned-out taillight aren't going to yell, scream, and argue, "There is nothing wrong with my car, go away!" Or even, "Yeah, whatever, I'll fix it later, it's not a big deal," as we are apt to do with an unrecognized trauma. But it is a fantastic analogy about perspective. When we are in our lives, living it on a daily basis, we don't often see the broken bits that are so obvious to those around us. We are navigating our world, thinking everything is status quo, until something or someone points it out to us. Or we crash. My late husband and I were married for 10 years before he told me about his history of being sexually abused. It took him that long to feel safe with his story, and he was married to a therapist. It also made so many things that we struggled with make sense. If you know or suspect your partner is coping with a trauma response, initiating the conversation rather than waiting for them to do so may be a very liberating experience. Of course, that doesn't mean force the conversation, but offering it as an option can help you both walk through a door they didn't even know how to open. Some other things to try or think about if your partner has experienced a trauma or you think they may have. 1. Expect them sometimes to not be present. Ask them if they are present if you get a sense that they are checked out. Ask if they need space to be alone or if your presence helps in that moment. Ask what you can do to help if they are struggling. "I think I lost you back there. Are you okay? Is there anything I can do to help?" 2. Create a safe word. No is a crappy safe word, especially if you are into BDSM or edge play. It can be something silly that lightens the mood, cheese doodles, or something that speaks to the experience, darkness. But decide on this ahead of time with an action plan of what you will both do if the safe word is used during intimacy. 3. If your partner needs space in the heat of the moment, offer them a chance to discuss it during a less stressful time within the next day or two. "I know last night really triggered you. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about now that you've had some time to think about it? Anything else that would help?" 4. It's okay to ask. If you can't really tell or aren't sure that your partner is really okay when they say they are, you can keep asking. Try to do so in the most non-accusatory way possible, of course, but only ask once. A power struggle of "I'm okay" versus "No, you are not" is a terrible one that nobody wins. Sometimes the partner with the trauma history is doing everything possible to be okay, and part of that is working through the issue in the moment and doing exactly what you were doing is a healing experience. Sometimes the sensations in a trauma survivor's body are very contradictory, and the partner working through a trauma has to choose what sensations to focus on at that moment in time. That can be a complicated process for their partner to be present for. I'm not sure if you like that. I was hoping that you did, and you said that you were okay, but I felt that maybe you were struggling. I want this to be good for you, so it won't hurt my feelings if there is something else you need or something you want me to do differently. And if you insist you really were okay, I promise to believe you until you tell me otherwise. Remember that if your partner has a trauma history, they are the one who is responsible for themselves in the end. You can't rescue them or fix them. You can be part of their journey rather than an obstacle, but only if they let you, and what they need is something that you have to give. And this may be a continuing conversation throughout your relationship. If you choose to be with them on their journey, don't forget your own wants, needs, and desires, and take responsibility for your self-care throughout the process as well. What if the problem is mine? And there was no problem before, but it's hitting me now. Why now? Congratulations! Your brain feels safe enough to let you know that there is a problem and some work to be done. Doesn't that suck? I have had many people tell me that their sex life with their current partner was amazing at first, but as it grew deeper and more connected, they started having more issues. That sounds counterintuitive, right? The safer you are, the safer you should feel. Except, the more connected you are and emotionally attached you are to your partner, the scarier it can get. That, unfortunately, makes a lot of sense because it requires a level of vulnerability that you may fear will be taken advantage of. But the trust and connection that continues to deepen can help you find the strength you need to continue your healing process. Trust is one of the hardest things for a trauma survivor to experience. But learning to trust again is an enormous sign of strength. Other life events can operate as a secondary trauma trigger, dragging you back to the initial unresolved event. Having a child together, whether through pregnancy, adoption, fostering, etc., or even just thinking about a child together can be a trigger. Moving away from a former circle of support can be another. Other big life events, like changes in jobs, schools, or the relationship itself, living together, getting engaged, getting married, can also feel destabilizing even when they are really good changes. When someone comes in to see me for trauma-related intimacy concerns that were not present earlier in the relationship, we usually find there is a fairly recent trigger that makes so much sense once we identify it. Oftentimes, just figuring that part out is a huge part of moving forward, because we all need to hear that what we are going through and our reaction to it is reasonable. How do I unfuck my trauma? The excellent news is this: both PTSD and trauma reactions that don't meet PTSD diagnosis criteria have the highest cure rate of any mental health diagnosis. Even complex traumas with messy co-occurring diagnoses are very, very treatable. The vast majority of people are able to recover from the symptomology they experience related to their trauma. The important thing is recognizing that the trauma is the root of the other stuff going on and will be the first focus of treatment, providing what we now term trauma-informed care. The structure of treatment is grounded in managing the trauma in a safe, structured way. This work can make a huge difference in the lives of individuals who struggle with a trauma history. If you are considering starting some therapeutic work related to a past trauma, consider using a therapist trained in an evidence-based trauma-informed care modality. Obviously, different types of treatments are more effective based on your particular situation, and also the types of interventions you feel most comfortable with. I've had lots of people dragged to my office by a parent or family member who announced, "I'm not talking about that shit and you can't make me." And fair enough, getting better doesn't require you to do so. Some of these include cognitive processing therapy, CPT. Along with understanding the interrelated impact of thoughts, behaviors, and feelings, CPT focuses on acquisition of coping techniques to empower individuals to respond to trauma triggers in a new and healthier way. There is an alternative form of CPT called CPT Cognitive Therapy Only, far more easily remembered as CPTC, that does not require you to complete a trauma narrative if you are uncomfortable with that part of treatment. You focus on your cognitions and reactions around the event rather than the story of the event itself in treatment. Research demonstrates that CPTC is just as effective as the traditional model. Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing Therapy, EMDR. EMDR uses many of the same techniques discussed previously in conjunction with body-centered therapies. Research has shown by engaging body work into the process, typically eye movement with this therapy, but other tactile stimulation may be explored, individuals feel more in control of their distressing thought and can more easily replace it with their preferred positive belief. Play therapy or expressive therapy. Don't discount play therapy as something just for kids. Techniques from play therapy can be very healing for adults because they engage our senses, foster creativity, and facilitate expressive communication. Anything that helps us express our experience creatively, not just play, can be of huge benefit to recovery. Art, journaling, and music are all forms of this type of work, and if the therapist is operating from a trauma-informed perspective, it can be a very healing experience. Prolonged exposure, PE. Prolonged exposure therapy is a form of therapy that helps clients process the trauma by actively remembering it and working through it in the safety of the counseling session by engaging in the story rather than trying to avoid it. Sometimes media, such as movies, are used to help facilitate the story and what the client remembers. Seeking safety. Designed specifically to help individuals who are struggling with both a trauma history and substance abuse, seeking safety focuses on creating safe coping skills and empowerment rather than specifically managing the trauma narrative. Research shows that individuals can recover from trauma without having to detail the trauma itself as part of their course of treatment. Trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy, TFCBT. TFCBT is a model designed to work with children, youth, and their caretakers, and can also work well with younger adults, 18 to 25-ish, as it targets developmental issues as part of treatment. This technique combines cognitive behavior therapy techniques, understanding the interrelation between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, with humanistic and family systems techniques that allow the individual to tell the story of their trauma in a safe way, once skills have been developed that help manage the distress these memories have caused in the past. When considering which modality of treatment will work best for you, the best question to ask yourself, and the one a good therapist will ask you in some way, shape, or form, is, what do you think you most need right now, rather than what do you want to do? No one knows more about what it is like to live inside your body and mind than you. What does your inner self tell you it needs? It could be, I really need to tell this story. Or it could be, I don't even know how to be safe in my daily life right now. Listen to that voice. It's your survivor's voice, the one that has kept you safe during your trauma experience and knows what you need to heal and move forward. And of course, this is just the list of the more traditional talk therapies. There is also a ton of research behind somatic-based treatments like yoga, acupuncture, hypnotherapy, and the like. I recommend doing both at once but start with what feels safest for you and take it from there. There is no wrong way to start. Creating a specific trauma response safety plan. Many people find that when working through intimacy issues, they sometimes trigger an unwanted response. You want to create a deeper connection with your partner and feel good inside your body, and something that you maybe didn't even realize becomes activated. When I use the word trigger, I'm using it clinically, meaning you stepped outside the present moment because something from your past made your brain say, "Danger, Will Robinson." Maybe you get flooded with memories. Maybe you freeze up and shut down. Maybe you completely disconnect. But it's not about the present moment and experience, but your past experiences have gotten reactivated. If you think such a response may be likely for you, plan on how you are going to manage it. Decide how much of that plan you want to share with any sexual partners you may be with at the time. If it arises unexpectedly, our brains and bodies are awesome at throwing us for a loop sometimes, it may make sense to step back and complete one of these plans before you try again. It's okay to renegotiate your action plan, slow down, and find ways to feel safe as you build toward increased intimacy. Some individuals feel much safer if they have a very specific safety plan in place in the event of a trauma response. One of the most difficult things about being triggered is feeling so overwhelmed by the experience that making any decision about what to do in the heat of that moment feels impossible. Your brain isn't working the way it normally does in that moment, so having a plan to fall back on can be very helpful to both you and any partner with whom you feel safe in sharing that plan. Sharing your plan does not mean you need to share the entirety of your trauma history. A respectful partner will not push you in that regard, agreeing to give you the space you need should you communicate that need. Remember that when we are sexually intimate, we are at our most vulnerable place. Even if everything is going well, we can feel that we are stepping outside of our comfort zone. This is also the most important time for us to open lines of communication, especially if we feel unsafe. Many people create an effective verbal plan with their partner. Others find a more formal plan to operate as their best safety net should they find themselves triggered. You can use the following questions to outline a more formal safety plan and open up the discussion with any partners. When you are feeling the most healthy, happy, joyful, and well, what does life look like? How do you feel? How do you interact with others? What things do you do, or are you willing to start doing, that operate as part of your daily wellness plan? What things have you noticed help you manage your triggers more effectively in a general sense? For example, many people have noticed that getting a certain amount of sleep and/or exercise is very beneficial to them. Some people feel better when they eat a certain way, meditate, and pray. Spend time with people they care about, or take time to enjoy hobbies that are meaningful to them. What activities do you think will work best in your wellness toolbox? What are some of the situations that you have come to realize operate as triggers for you? These are less the big catastrophic things that we sometimes worry about, but the things that can happen on a more regular basis. For many people, this can be certain situations, like being in a crowded room or not doing well on a project, dates, like a holiday or birthday, or something they connect to in a very sensory way, like a certain smell or tone of voice. We often don't know what all of our triggers are and may sometimes get triggered without any idea what caused it. But if we start keeping notes when it does happen, we can often start to figure them out. So you may want to consider this list a work in progress that you keep adding to over time. What are your early warning signs that you may be getting triggered? What kinds of thoughts do you have? What emotions arise? What kind of behaviors do you engage in that you don't typically engage in? If you were triggered, what are the things you can do for yourself to help you manage these triggers? These are often things that you already do for your general wellness that become especially important in these situations, but may also be coping skills or activities that you use when you are in especially tough situations. While there are a lot of things that you are able to do for yourself, there may be times you need help from others, especially if you are working on your intimate relationships. What do you need from others? Who do you trust to provide that support? How will you ask them about it? How will you know that you have been triggered past a point that you, and the individuals who traditionally support you, can handle? If you are at a point at which you are not able to manage these triggers on your own, or with the assistance of the people who traditionally support you, what is the next step for you? Once your crisis has been managed, how will you know when you are feeling safe and secure again? Once you try out and then use your safety plan, jot down any notes about what worked and didn't, and make adjustments as needed. And one of the best tools I've found for helping people reconnect to intimacy after trauma is using sensate focus exercises, my instructions for which are covered in this book. Sexuality, religion, and spirituality. They try to say what you are, spiritual or sexual. They wonder about Solomon and all his wives. In the body of the world, they say, there is a soul, and you are that. But we have ways within each other that will never be said by anyone. Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. Have you ever read something that you thought was a normal self-help book that turned out to be connected to a specific faith tradition and you totally felt deceived? Hopefully by now you know that's not my game plan, but if you were looking at this chapter with great suspicion, I totally feel you. Let me put that to rest, though. Spirituality, as the larger experience of purposeful belonging, is a big part of most people's lives. And if it isn't part of your life now, chances are still pretty good that it was a huge part of the messages you got growing up, whether you wanted them or not. Spirituality isn't a bad thing. It provides hope, healing, and connection to something larger than ourselves, which means that religion, at its best, is the organized expression of our spiritual selves. Just as we are hardwired for connection, intimacy, and touch, we are hardwired for ritual. For many people, religious practice fulfills their human need for the ritual expression of spirit. Being a spiritual person and expressing that spirituality through religious practice isn't wrong or unimportant or invalid. But in The World According to Dr. Faith, the problem lies when that practice lies in conflict with something fundamental about who we are as people. Religion is totally boss when it helps align with our moral center, when it reminds us to be good and kind and patient, to care for others that need caring. But it's a huge fucking problem when it tells us we are fundamentally broken or sinful simply because we exist. According to mainstream media, the biggest conflict is when individuals have a sexual orientation or gender identity that their religious practice deems sinful. And yeah, those are big ones, and more on these issues in part two. But in reality, it bumps up all the time. In what level of commitment should we have with another person before engaging in sexual activity, marriage only? Is solo sex acceptable? Or is that cheating on a partner? Is porn usage sinful? What about BDSM, polyamory, fetish play? This isn't to say that all of those thou shalt nots are wrong. If I am committed to sex positivity, that means supporting what's right for every individual and relationship. In my practice, I provide information and options and research and help individuals reach their own conclusions about what spiritual and religious practices align with who they are as people. For example, if someone's faith tradition dictates that porn usage is unacceptable, and they find that they agree that it isn't a positive and fulfilling part of their lives, my job is to respect and honor that. and I'm endeavoring to do the same thing here. The intent of unpacking our religious messages is not to dissuade you for any of them, but to help you recognize them and evaluate whether or not they make sense for your authentic self. So, all of my later chapters that bump into these more complicated topics of sexual expression, but talking about how all of these issues overlay with our human expression of our spiritual experience, is also important. The general message from sex-positive, affirming people is along the lines of, well then, fuck religion. But not everyone wants to give up something that has grounded their identity in so many ways throughout their lives. It's akin to saying, fuck your mom, she's an abusive asshole. And you're thinking, yeah, but she's still my mom. I didn't know about that. While I was raised in a deeply religious home, I was also fortunate enough to be raised by parents who attached no shame or restrictions to sex. Not everyone has been fortunate to have that experience, and many individuals struggle because of it. Most worrisome to me as a therapist specializing in this type of work is the enormous sense of shame that many people experience due to these conflicts. Brené Brown, the well-known shame researcher, notes that there is a fundamental difference between guilt and shame. Guilt implies that you made a mistake. Shame implies that you are a mistake. One of the most important tasks in intimacy work is to navigate how spiritual and religious practice is informing an individual's sexual expression. My job is not to judge individual choices about how their spirituality informs their sexual expression, because that is a deeply personal choice that no one has a right to judge. My job is to help people navigate where conflict has arisen in this regard, and to help them navigate these conflicts without the shame experience that is often attached to them in a way that resolves them or at least makes peace with them. Finding people you trust to help you work through the process as you reflect on these questions can be invaluable. Reading people who have dedicated their lives to resolving this conflict may also help your own practice, and within later chapters, there are book recommendations associated with some of these specific issues. But this whole section is designed to help you figure out what your unique experiences are in this domain and how they have been impacting your intimate relationships, right? Sometimes just asking the right question helps us go, oh yeah, I didn't even think about how that's a thing in my life. So here's some shit to start asking yourself. Some questions to ask yourself. Are your religious or spiritual beliefs and practices different than many of the individuals in the community, even if they identify with the same faith tradition? How have your spiritual and/or religious beliefs and practices changed through childhood, adolescence, and adulthood? How do the teachings of your spiritual beliefs and practices address sexual intimacy? What role does it play in your spiritual development? Have you undergone any body modifications as a consequence of your religious beliefs that affect your sexual self or practices? For example, circumcision, lack of circumcision, castration, female or male, tattooing, piercing, or other body art? If so, how have these changed your self-image, your ability to engage in sexual intimacy? How do you view the integration between your spiritual self and sexual self? Do your spiritual or religious beliefs and practices prescribe any suggestions or rules about sex and intimacy? If so, what are your thoughts and feelings about these suggestions or rules? Do you engage in any sexual activities that are at conflict with your spiritual or religious beliefs and practices? If so, what are your thoughts and feelings about these conflicts? According to your spiritual or religious beliefs and practices, what may be some of the consequences of engaging in activities that are in conflict with this belief system? If so, what are your thoughts and feelings about these possible consequences? Have you or someone you know experienced negative consequences from a conflict between your religious beliefs and your sexual practices? For example, judgment, criticism, exclusion from certain events, membership in general, corporal punishment, etc.? How did that affect you? If you were partnered, do you and your partner practice the same faith tradition? If no, how is it similar from each other's? How is it different? If you were partnered, do you or your partner experience any conflict between sexual expression and religious beliefs and practices? If so, how have these conflicts been negotiated? Have they been navigated successfully, or are there still areas of disagreement? Have you received any guidance from a spiritual or religious leader about this integration? What was their advice or feedback? How about from a mental health professional or medical professional? What was their advice or feedback? How about from family or peers? What was their advice or feedback? Did you receive conflicting feedback if you consulted with one or more persons? What would be the ideal solution in regards to possible conflicts you may be experiencing that would allow you to be both a spiritual and sexual individual? Have you been advised on any possible avenues of compromise? Are there any avenues of compromise that you and/or your partner are willing to consider? Are there any areas that you and/or your partner feel are non-negotiable? What are your thoughts and feelings about these areas at this time? Have they changed from the past? Do you think they are likely to change over time? Changing bodies, sexual disorders, and other fuckitude. Oh, hey there. I have a normal human body, capable of misfires and weirdness and continuing issues regarding its maintenance and functioning. I bet you do too. In fact, I have a sneaking suspicion that we all do. So why don't we talk about how this whole walking around in a wonky meat suit affects our sexual intimacy? Because shame. Because embarrassment. Because not even realizing the connection. Because not knowing what to say. Time to start thinking about and talking about these issues in a better way. Sexual disorders. When you think about it, keeping your sex life fully charged can be akin to tending to a hothouse orchid. So many little things can go wrong to knock things off course. We are talking about all the ways sexual dysfunction can manifest, right? So let's start off by talking about the different categories of sexual disorders. We tend to think first of erectile dysfunction, because that's where the pharmaceutical dollars are, but there are actually four different types of sexual disorders. Desire disorders occurs when there is no desire or interest in sex. This is not the same thing as being ace or demi or gray, which we cover elsewhere in this book. Arousal disorders. Arousal disorders occur when the mind is ready and willing, which doesn't happen in desire disorders, but the body isn't up to the task. This is the category for erectile dysfunction, though of course you don't have to have a penis to experience an arousal disorder. Orgasm disorders. When the individual either cannot orgasm or it takes way longer and extra effort. Pain disorders. When intercourse literally hurts, this generally affects individuals with vaginas more than individuals with penises. These issues may manifest in relation to other bodily changes, or they may present themselves just because they do. We are often so wrapped up in sexual disorders that are resolved by taking a blue pill that we don't discuss these other issues. So if you are realizing you maybe fit into one of these categories, listen on. Aging. Working within an aging body isn't anyone's idea of fun, but we all agree it beats the alternative. Fortunately, we live in an era where it isn't presumed we are out to pasture by our mid-40s. At the age I am now, my grandmother was already a grandmother, mine, to be precise, wearing sneakers and house